Why don't you turn back to Psalm 130. You shut your Bible, it's on page 624, and it'll be up on the screen as well. There is a waiting that looks hopeless, because frankly, it is hopeless. One of our young people, I will not mention her name, when Lib and I started coming to this church, we'd see her every week, and she would tell me pretty much every week that one day she would be taller than I am. She would stand next to me, she would jump up, and she would say, "Soon I'm going to be taller than you." Now, she's still, even now, got more time to grow. And I can say quite confidently that she will never be as tall as I am. She's still a foot short at this point. But there is a waiting that looks hopeless, but is not. I don't know if you've seen the weather forecast for this week. Thursday, apparently, we may well be, you know, not in work, not in school. I'm possibly over-egging this a little bit, but snow is coming, apparently. And yet Thursday will be the 1st of March. It'll be March, and it'll be freezing, and there might even be snow. And it may look at that point as though spring will never come. It'll look, you might say, hopeless. And yet it won't be, will it? With all the combined years of experience that we've got here, we know that spring will eventually come. The temperatures will rise, flowers will bud, and spring will be here. But Thursday, that might look a little bit hopeless. It might also be wonderful fun. Psalm 130 calls us to hope. It calls us to wait in hope upon God. And it might look fruitless. But it's not based on what can be seen, nor on our ability to dictate circumstances. If you wake up Thursday morning desperately hoping for snow, but there is none, you and I will be able to do nothing about it. But our hope, despite how hopeless it might look, is based upon God. It is based upon who God is, who He has revealed Himself to be. Listen to the call to God's people that the psalmist makes at the end of this psalm. Verse 7 to 8. "Israel, put your hope in the Lord. For with the Lord is unfailing love, and with Him is full redemption. He Himself will redeem Israel from all their sins." He says, put your hope in God. People of God, put your hope in Him. And the writer of this psalm, this song, a man or a woman, we don't know who it is. I will probably say him. I think there's a fair chance it's written by King David. But as he calls other people to put their hope in God, he does it from a place of experience. He does it from a point of being at the lowest of the low, and putting his trust, his hope, his expectations in God. And so in this psalm, he tells us a story of grace, a story of mercy, a story of the goodness of God. He points people who are at the lowest ebb and says, there is a God who acts. There is a God who comes. There is a God who steps in. Trust in Him. And so he'll talk about his need. He'll talk about God's character. And then he will talk about the response to God. And we're just going to, a few minutes, just work through this psalm, this song of grace. The God who acts. So look down again at Psalm 130. And let me read the opening few verses. "Out of the depths I cry to you, Lord. Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to my cry for mercy. If you, Lord, kept a record of sins, Lord, who could stand?" He paints a picture of being low, in the depths. Is he referring to the sea? Well, it's a metaphor. He's talking to about the deepest, darkest hour, a place where the world is on top of his shoulders, where it's dark, where it's hopeless, where he cannot see a way out. He is surrounded, he is covered, he is trapped, he is dying. And he calls to God. He recognizes, verse 2, the need for mercy. He needs somebody else to act. He needs God to work because he can't save himself. We sang that song, didn't we, at the start of our service? Who, O Lord, could save themselves? And the psalmist's answer is, I couldn't. I couldn't do it. He recognizes that he needs the Lord to act. And more than that, he recognizes that the Lord can act in compassion to save him. We don't know what his specific circumstances are. Maybe he's talking generally. Maybe you can think to the lowest point of your life, the biggest struggle. And maybe even the psalmist includes that with us as he talks about the depths. That point where it's all darkness and no light. Where it's cold. It's hopeless. Verse 3, if you, Lord, kept a record of sins, who could stand? He nails down his biggest issue. It is sin. The reason for his distress, the reason for the pit of despair, the sea of trouble that he's in, is sin. The psalmist recognizes what the Bible will say over and over and over again. That his biggest issue is not the circumstances that afflict him. The biggest issue is not out there, but it's in here. It is the record of wrong committed by this man or woman, committed by any man or woman, committed by every man and woman against God. It is that which causes him to sing this song. Sin. And here's the thing. You may be sat there even now thinking, okay, I've experienced hardship in this life. But sin? Is that really my biggest issue? And you may be sat there thinking, you know what? Life's just okay. This guy's having a bad week, a bad month, maybe even a bad life, but I'm okay. Things are going, to be honest, fine for me. In fact, we may be sat here this evening and we may be a lot like Elizabeth Swaney. You may not recognize the name. You may not have watched as much Winter Olympics as I have over the last couple of weeks. Elizabeth Swaney is an American lady. She's nearly 40. And in the Winter Olympics, she skied for Hungary in the ski halfpipe event. Is this ringing any bells with anybody? You may have seen her, not because, as is typical for competitors in this event, because she pinged down the half pipe, went up the side, did six flips, landed, went back up the other side. No, no. What Elizabeth Swaney did was set off from the top, very cautiously, and gently skied to one side of the half pipe, did a little turn, and then skied to the other side, did a little turn, and so on and so on, down to the bottom. She finished dead last in the qualifiers for the ski halfpipe. And whilst everybody else was attempting the flips, the twists, the grabs, the big air, she just meandered her way down and finished dead last. And she said it was a great victory. She said she had only hoped to encourage other people to take up the sport. But the reality is that on each side of the halfpipe, as she went down and as every other competitor went down, there were judges. Judges looking for the complexity of the tricks that were tried. Judges looking at how straight her skis were and whether she grabbed all the way through the tricks. And when she got to the bottom and said, I've come and done what I hoped to do, I've had success, they went, no, you haven't. You were rubbish. And fair play, she didn't fall over. But honestly, I don't think any of us would have fallen over doing that. Okay, maybe an overstatement. But she was a serene skier. And yet the judges would have said and did say to her in her marks, you have failed. You have fallen short. You may talk about a moral victory. I'm not being funny. I can't see any Hungarians taking up that event based on what they saw. It wasn't exciting. It wasn't fun. It was, quite frankly, pathetic. And they'll change the rules so that nobody can do it next time. She's not deserving of a medal. In fact, she has been judged to have fallen short of what was expected, of what is demanded. And in the same way, as the psalmist reaches this point and says, my sin. If you, Lord, kept a record of sins, Lord, who could stand? In the end, it is not our opinion of how we are doing that matters. There is a God who sees our lives, who sees our hearts, who sees what we do in secret, who hears what we say, who knows our every thought, our every motive, our every attitude. And what he sees is not the redacted image that we present to the world. It is the full picture. And when the full picture of our lives are seen before the God who made us, who created us to know him, to love him, to image him, who can stand? Who can stand? Whose record will stack up? Whose heart delights in the goodness of God? Whose choices reflect the wisdom of God? Whose actions show obedience to the self-revealed God of the universe? Not me. Not you. Lord, who could stand? And notice then he turns to who God is. Verse 4, but with you, Lord, there is forgiveness. The hope of the psalmist is not in behavior modification. It's not in marginal gains improvement. I'll do a little bit better tomorrow than I did today. It's not in the circumstances changing. No, his hope, his only hope, comes from looking at who God is. But with you, there is forgiveness. He looks into God's character, who God has revealed himself to be throughout history, and says, my only hope is that you, God, love to forgive. You, God, are patient in dealing with people who should be condemned. You, God, even with the people who you've already been at work in and who've now turned away from you, you, God, are patient. You forgive. You love to forgive failures. Even those who fail again and again and again and again. He doesn't look at God and see weakness. He sees love. He sees unbelievable forgiveness. He sees that there is hope even for him. It's not that God is a soft touch, but more that God, in his full revelation of himself, says, I will choose again and again to forgive for those who turn to me. And he does. He looks to God and finds hope. And notice the psalmist's response. A God who forgives, verse 4, so that we can, with reverence, serve you. His response as he sees God's forgiveness, as God's speaking into his life, as he sees the sin and forgives him, so that this man or woman, so that we men and women can serve God with reverence. But also then there's a waiting. Look at verse 5. I wait for the Lord. My whole being or my soul waits, and in his word I put my hope. More than watchmen, wait for the morning. More than watchmen, wait for the morning. This is not an effortless waiting. It's not sitting back. It's not passive. It is active. It takes up his whole being, his every thought, to wait on God, the one who forgives. And it involves holding on to his word. See that in verse 5. In his word I put my hope, in what God has said, in who God has revealed himself to be in the history of his people. I will put my hope there. Waiting is not effortless. It involves actively holding on to what God has already done. The way that he has made a people as the pinnacle of his creation. The way he has blessed them. The way he has given hope when they have fallen again and again and again. Holding on to what God has already done as revealed in his word. Holding on to what God has already said as revealed in his word. Holding on to what God has already promised as revealed in his word. And he gives us an illustration. This is what it's like. It's like a watchman stationed on the walls of the city, given the job of standing and watching, seeing if there is a threat coming during the night whilst people sleep. And the watchman waits. Waiting. Waiting for the sun to rise. His work is not done until the sun comes up. His work and the safety of the city is not assured until the sun comes up. And so the watchman strains his eyes towards the horizon, searching for the first lifting of darkness, the first point where the blackness becomes gray. The first sunbeam breaking over the horizon onto the land. And he watches, and he watches, and he waits. And it will come. As surely as day follows night, the sun will rise. And as surely as day follows night, God will come to the aid of his people. No matter the darkness, no matter the depths that you are in right now, no matter the weight of your sin, no matter if you've fallen back into an old pattern of sin, Israel, church, put your hope in the Lord. For with the Lord is unfailing love, and with him is full redemption. He himself will redeem Israel, his people, from all their sins. So how do we wait? How do we wait upon God? Well, one of the ways we do that is by coming together and sharing the meal that Jesus gave his followers. Hopeful waiting. Looking at what God has done and trusting in what he will do. Why do we take communion? Perhaps you've asked that question. Maybe not out loud. But you thought, well, we keep doing this. Maybe you've grown up in church and you've experienced it every few weeks, every year of your life. Why do we take communion? Well, one of the reasons is it helps us to wait with hope. It helps us to wait with hope. And it points us to the cross. It is there that our sin is revealed and exposed like nowhere else. Because both the seriousness of our sin and the consequence of our sin is shown as Jesus, God the Son, goes to the cross for a people who cannot stand because their sin, the list of their sin, if it was quantified, would stand so, so high. There at the cross, our God is revealed. The God who makes a way for us to be forgiven. With him there is forgiveness. And then we see that as Jesus hangs on the cross. What are his words towards the people who do this to them? Forgive them, Lord. Forgive them. for they know not what they do. It is there at the cross that God's unfailing love is displayed. Most clearly, most obviously. We ask the question, God, do you truly love me? Especially when in the deepest pit, when our sin weighs most heavily on us, when we failed most spectacularly, most obviously, whether the world sees it or not. It is there we ask that question, God, how can you love me? Do you really love me? Why have you not given up on me? And the cross says, this is how much I love you. This is the extent to which I will go. It is there at the cross that we are redeemed. The psalmist talks about the need for redemption, but with God there is full redemption. It is there that the price is paid to set us free. The price that covers every sin. It covers that thing that's been on your mind since the moment I started talking about sin. It covers that thing that is in your past, that action, that word, that deed. It covers that hardness that nobody else sees but that you feel towards somebody else or towards some other people. When we confess our sin, we find at the cross there is forgiveness and redemption, even for us. And what communion does, it points us to the fact that God is coming again. That Jesus is coming back. That this world is awaiting for something that is to come. That we are pilgrims headed for another world. A new earth. That this is not all that there is. And so it helps and encourages us to keep going. And to say that together as God's people, our hope is only in Jesus. That our forgiveness is found only in him. And that our message to each other and to the world is that there is a God who loves us, who has died for us. And we remind ourselves of that. We wait for the return of Jesus Christ. We wait for the remaking and renewing of this world. We wait for final and for full justice. And we do so as we kneel at the cross, with our sin confessed, finding our sin is forgiven, where our hope is renewed and replenished, where we worship God and we serve him. See, it may look hopeless to the watching world. The church may look weak. What is our hope in? Well, if it is ourselves, yeah, I can understand why the world looks on and says that's hopeless. But if it is in him, if it is in the God in whom we find forgiveness, the God who would act in this way to show his greatness, his great love, then it is not hopeless waiting. It is hopeful, hope-filled waiting, joyful waiting even. Once we have seen Christ, once we have received his spirit within us, once we have known the love of the Father for us, for me, then our hope is certain. The Bible calls certain hope faith, directing our trust, our future, our lives, and putting it in the hands of the God of Psalm 130. So we're going to come and take of this meal, and we're going to renew our hope as we wait. And before we do that, let's take a moment to pray by ourselves, to confess our sin, to entrust ourselves again to this God, to call on him for mercy, to turn to the one in whom there is forgiveness. So just for a couple of minutes, let's respond to God in our own hearts, and then I'll lead us in prayer.